This is Professor Richard Carlson. This is the Employment Law Lecture scheduled for Thursday, October 13. In our last class, we finished up the materials on workers' compensation. We discussed the question of extreme employer fault. Remember that the general principle of workers' compensation law is that fault is irrelevant. But just as some states have attempted to address the problem of extreme fault by employees, some states have also attempted to address the problem of extreme fault by employers. The argument that's been raised is that when an employer is extremely negligent, perhaps grossly negligent or willfully negligent, the result ought to be the same as if the employer had intended the outcome of its negligence. In other words, we lift the usual exclusive remedy defense and allow the employee to sue in tort. Not all states have followed this approach. I think I've mentioned before that in Texas, gross or willful negligence is only usefully asserted against an employer in a wrongful death action by survivors. Texas still clings to the standard that negligence is simply irrelevant unless you can prove that the employer's misconduct rose to the level of an intentional tort. From there, we moved on to the next section in Chapter 5. That's occupational safety preventive laws, mainly the Occupational Safety and Health Act on the federal level. And we distinguished between the specific standards enacted under that act and the general duty clause, which allows the enforcement agency, OSHA, to charge employers with dangerous behavior or misconduct without having to point to a particular specific standard that has been enacted in advance. The general duty clause, as stated in the Act, seems to require a workplace free from hazard, but as we discussed last time, the general duty clause actually requires much less than perfect safety. The employer need only deal with recognized hazards, and those are hazards that are technologically and economically feasible to deal with. And they must be hazards that involve a significant risk to significant risk of serious injury or death. Finally, we'd begun to talk about employee self-help, the ways that employees can protect themselves from dangers at the workplace. And one of the important means of employee self-help that we discussed was the so-called work refusal rule, where by OSHA standard, an employee can, in good faith, engage in an act of insubordination, refusing to carry out an order or perform certain work if the employee reasonably believes that he is in danger of a serious injury or death. So let's advance to our next slide now. This begins the NLRB versus Washington Aluminum, which is a case that illustrates yet another way that employees can engage in self-help. Let's recap what happened in the Washington Aluminum case, advancing to the next slide. This case involves a so-called concerted work stoppage for a safety-related reason. The employees in Washington Aluminum have stopped working because their work has become unbearably cold. The furnace that usually heats the workplace is broken. The employer says he's trying to get it fixed, but in the meantime, it's below freezing where the employees work. And so, talking together, they agree as a group that they're simply not going to work under these conditions. Now, before we discuss the particular rule that protects the employees in this case, let's talk about the applicability of the other rule that we've already discussed, that is the so-called work refusal rule. You might have wondered why it is that the employees didn't allege OSHA as a basis for their protection in any respect, and the simple answer is that OSHA was not enacted yet at the time of this case. But even if OSHA were in force at the time of this story, remember that it only deals with the risk of serious injury or death. That's true under the general duty clause. It's also true under the work refusal rule. Thus, if these employees had depended on the work refusal rule, they would have been required to prove that exceptional coldness exposed them to a risk of serious injury or death. Now, it's not completely beyond reason that the employees could have asserted some claim here. The general rule is that mere discomfort does not involve an OSHA matter, and there are a number of cases that support that idea. Still, you could argue that working in below freezing weather does expose one to serious injury. The reason that the issue doesn't come up much is because so many employees have to work in extreme cold, and there just isn't any technologically or economically feasible way to deal with it. I suppose the employees might have argued in this case that fixing the heater makes the solution to their cold weather both technologically and economically feasible. In any event, they do have an uphill battle here because they're going to have to show more than mere discomfort. They're going to have to prove that weather conditions presented a risk of serious injury. That's whether they're calling OSHA to cite the employer for a violation of the general duty clause. It also is true if the employees are attempting to invoke the OSHA work refusal rule. But the employees had another basis for their protection. They invoked the National Labor Relations Act's Section 7. It may take a moment to remember what Section 7 is. That's that provision of federal collective bargaining law that allows employees to engage in concerted activity for the purpose of mutual aid and protection. And we discussed Section 7 last when we were discussing the way employers and employees negotiate wages. Now, one of the ways that employees can engage in concerted activity is by engaging in a strike. In fact, that was obviously and clearly what Congress had in mind when they referred to concerted activity. Striking is classic organized employee activity. The employer argues that the employees were not protected under the law because they acted unreasonably. They didn't wait around to see if the furnace would eventually be fixed. They overreacted to conditions at the workplace. But one of the things that we learn about Section 7 that's useful in a case of extreme discomfort like this is that employees don't have to prove that they made a reasonable decision. If that were true, then lots of so-called concerted activity by employees would be unprotected. And, of course, even if it were reasonable behavior, you'd always be at the risk that some administrative law judge would disagree with you about what was reasonable under the circumstances. So under Section 7, we allow employees to engage in concerted activity for what other people might regard as unreasonable goals or unreasonable complaints. Although it's not entirely clear from the court's opinion, it is important to mention that there are limits on the employee's choice of means to oppose the employer. Now, in this case, the employees have engaged in a spontaneous strike. From an employer's point of view, that might seem unreasonable because it's so harmful to the employer's business. But again, striking is a classic concerted employee activity. And if we're going to protect concerted activity, there has to be some ground for protecting employee strike activity. I'll simply say that there are limits to the ways employees can engage in strikes. There are strikes that go overboard, and certainly occupying the employer's plant in a sit-in strike, breaking property, sabotaging the business, these go well beyond the limits of what employees are allowed to do in the form of industrial action. But a fuller treatment of that would have to be part of a course in collective bargaining law. For now, let's advance to our next slide, which is when a strike breaches a contract. Collective bargaining agreements between unions and employers typically prohibit a strike or a work stoppage. That's part of a quid pro quo for the employer's agreeing to a labor contract. He understands that in return for agreeing to certain terms and conditions of employment, he's going to have at least a 3-year term of peace. I say 3 years because that's a pretty standard duration for a collective bargaining agreement. Now, the fact that the union, on behalf of the employees, has agreed to prohibit strikes means that the employer can lawfully terminate an employee for violating a no-strike clause. You may have heard of the term wildcat strike. One reason that a strike might be a wildcat strike is that a subgroup of the employees has decided to violate the contract and perhaps violate the union's wishes by engaging in their own strike. Now, here's a dilemma that the courts and law enforcement authorities faced early on under the National Labor Relations Act. What happens if the employees feel an immediate need to put down their tools and stop working because of a safety-related condition? Well, now that we have OSHA and the work refusal rule, we could simply say that a collective bargaining agreement cannot override an employee's protected work refusal. It would not be regarded as a work stoppage, although when you think about it, it is a kind of work stoppage because the employee is objecting and opposing his employer, and he's doing so by refusing to work. But originally there wasn't anything like that to protect unionized employees who had agreed to a no-strike clause, so Congress enacted Section 143. In essence, Section 143 says that ceasing work due to abnormally dangerous conditions is not to be deemed a strike regardless of the contract or any other law of or federal statute. Now, arguably, Section 143 is a little bit broader than the work refusal rule because employees can invoke it because conditions are simply abnormally dangerous. In other words, it's not the usual state of affairs. Something abnormal has happened. But beyond that, the statute simply says abnormally dangerous. It doesn't say that the employees have to prove that the danger involved a serious risk of serious personal injury or death. Maybe it would apply to a case of extreme discomfort. In any event, Section 143 merely means that the employees can't be fired for violating the contract. They're still protected under Section 7, provided they engage in concerted activity. And that should remind you of another arbitrary limitation. A single employee acting for himself is not engaging in concerted activity. And that takes us to the next subject, which is protecting employer rights. OSHA wasn't really designed to create rights for employers, by the way, but we do have to talk about employer rights because employers have constitutional rights that may limit the way that the Secretary of Labor enforces the law. So advance to the next slide now, which is Barlow's versus Marshall. Barlow's is a famous case involving the inspection power of federal administrative agencies, and you may have read this case possibly in constitutional law. Most certainly if you've studied administrative law. OSHA clearly raises some constitutional questions because of its statement in Section 657 that the Secretary, upon presenting appropriate credentials, in other words, his ID or his agent's ID, is authorized to enter without delay and at reasonable times any workplace within reasonable limits and in a reasonable manner. Now, on the surface, that simply seems to say that the Department of Labor has to arrive at a reasonable hour, not 1 o'clock in the morning, and he has to behave himself when he's there. He can't trash the employer's workplace, and he has to act reasonably, but other than that, he seems to have an absolute right to inspect, and he has the right to enter the workplace without delay. Well, in the Barlow's case, the employer objected to the inspection and attempted to oppose the issuance of a subpoena in this case. So let's look at how the Supreme Court deals with the application of the Fourth Amendment to an employer's right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. Let's advance to the next slide. Preliminary issues, does the Fourth Amendment apply? Now, the situation here is that the employer has refused to allow an inspection. We wouldn't have a Fourth Amendment issue if the employer had granted consent, permission to the search. And employers often do this. I'll explain why that is in just a moment. OSHA can always inspect when it has the employer's permission. The Fourth Amendment doesn't stop the police or any government agency from accepting your invitation to inspect your residence or your business. But this is a case where the employer has refused to allow the inspection voluntarily. The question then becomes whether the Fourth Amendment applies to this inspection. And this is different from the usual police case because this is an agency that is inspecting for a civil law purpose. And one of the questions the court has to deal with in the Barlow's case is whether the Fourth Amendment was intended only to apply to searches by the police for criminal law purposes. And to make a long story short, the court rules that as a practical matter, there's really not that much difference between civil law and criminal law when it comes to government regulation. Either way, the government is entering your place of business, searching your property, and exposing you to the threat of perhaps very substantial penalties. Moreover, there's always the possibility under OSHA that the government will find a violation that is so severe that it's going to charge you with a criminal violation. So the court holds, yes, of course, the Fourth Amendment does apply to an inspection that at the outset was intended only for civil law enforcement. Next question. Does the Fourth Amendment to apply to businesses as opposed to personal residences? And the court invokes history in support of the argument that the Fourth Amendment does apply here because, after all, when you consider the events leading up to the Revolutionary War and the reasons that the Fourth Amendment was deemed to be so important back in the late 18th century, it's clear that business had everything to do with it. So the court holds that, yes, the Fourth Amendment does apply to the search of a business or an employer's workplace. Finally, we reach the question, can the employer reasonably expect privacy in an area closed to the public but open to its own employees? Note that if the area were open to the general public, there would be nothing to stop an inspector from simply walking through the work area. This would certainly be true if we were talking about a retail store, for example. An inspector can just pretend that he's shopping and he has as much right to be there as anybody else. But obviously there are some areas of the workplace that are going to be closed to the public. They're only open to employees. And the question became in this case whether opening part of your workplace to your employees makes it no longer private. And the answer is, privacy is your right to be able to control access to your property and to grant some people permission and others no permission at all. Not unlike your house. The fact that you have guests over to your house at the time the police arrive doesn't mean that you have to invite the police to the same party. So the court holds that yes, the employer can reasonably expect privacy in an area closed to the public, but open to its own employees. Next slide. What does the Fourth Amendment require if the employer says no? Well, if you've studied this issue in constitutional law or criminal procedure, you'll know that a law enforcement officer needs either the consent of the person to be searched or a court-issued warrant based on probable cause. That historically has been the standard under the Fourth Amendment. But there's a problem with this when we're talking about regulatory searches, especially those that involve matters of public safety. The best way to enforce safety and health laws is to have random, non-consensual surprise inspections. The only way that you're going to be sure that the employer is not exposing its employees to extreme hazards is to have the right and the authority to come in before the employer has had an opportunity to clean up the mess in anticipation of the inspection. Moreover, although the police might make the same argument when it comes to inspecting for drugs or other criminal behavior, Remember that the consequences of an OSHA inspection are pretty light. In most cases, we're talking about a fine that is less than what an attorney earns in 1 hour of their time. So the court reaches a compromise here, an important compromise for American administrative law. The compromise is this, that for administrative agencies like OSHA, probable cause is not necessary. What we need is some lesser standard for agencies like OSHA. And here's the substitute standard. The agency needs only a rational administrative plan for its inspection that somehow prevents arbitrary selection of employers. Now, while you're thinking about what we might mean by a rational administrative plan, understand the risk that we're trying to address here. The risk is that runaway, corrupt, or ill-motivated inspectors will select particular employers for inspection simply to retaliate against them, maybe because they didn't donate enough money to the right political party, maybe because they haven't paid a bribe recently. These are the sorts of problems that you can run into if you give law enforcement officials too much authority. They can become corrupted. The police, of course, are limited by the probable cause standard and the necessity of a judicially issued warrant. In the case of administrative agencies, we're not going to require probable cause, but we do require some administrative plan that will prevent that kind of arbitrary selection and discretion in the local inspector. So let's advance to the next slide. OSHA inspection by warrant, will it really be a surprise? OSHA's usual practice is to ask for employer consent first. The inspector will typically show up at your doorstep, knock on the door, and ask, pretty please, may I inspect your workplace? Won't always happen that way, because sometimes they know when they're dealing with a really difficult employer with a track record, they will get the warrant in advance so that they really can conduct a completely surprise inspection. But in the usual case, they'll just ask for consent. It's only if the employer refuses that OSHA will typically seek a court's warrant. And at this point, the OSHA agent needs only to show the judge or the magistrate that the selection of this employer for inspection is based on a proper administrative plan. Now, this may give the employer a chance to oppose or quash the warrant, or at the very least to prepare for the inspection. So what should an employer do when OSHA comes knocking? It doesn't have the warrant yet. It's asking, pretty please, should you refuse to let them in? Well, you can't know for sure what the best answer is for any particular employer, but here is an important practical consideration. Statistics do show that employers that deny access to the OSHA inspector are far more likely to be cited for violations when the inspector finally comes back with a warrant, and they get a citation or a list of citations that includes a lot more violations and perhaps more serious violations. Now, we don't know whether that's because the inspector is simply being retaliatory because you put him to so much additional work, or maybe it's simply because the employers who refuse to grant voluntary access, they know they have a lot to hide. You can take those statistics for what they're worth, or rather your client can take those statistics for what they're worth. It's a discussion you simply have to have with your client if it comes up. And fortunately, the ultimate decision is not really yours, it's theirs. Next slide. Now we'll talk about the administrative plan, as well as other grounds to inspect. What would qualify as an administrative plan? Well, the leading case in this regard is called National Engineering versus Oshrock. In that case, the court upheld a plan that was essentially a lottery. It involved OSHA selecting a handful of targeted industries. We're going to focus, for example, on construction this year. And then you put a number for every employer that you've identified on a list who's registered with you, you have a drawing, a lottery, and you select randomly employers to be inspected. That qualifies as an administrative plan because by its design, it takes authority away from local inspectors to use their discretion for any kind of nefarious reason. Now, let's go to the next bullet there. There are other ways that OSHA can conduct an inspection, other reasons that they can have a warrant or perhaps search even without a warrant. First of all, the OSHA can still get a warrant based the old-fashioned way on a probable cause case. Now, what would constitute probable cause? And the answer is an employee called OSHA up to report what he believed was a violation, and the employee's claim sounds pretty credible. Or perhaps the OSHA inspector read about this in the newspaper. There was a terrible disaster and 15 employees were killed in an awful fire. At this point, OSHA might very well just get a warrant without even going to your door first, because not only can it get a warrant easily without your being within their administrative plan, but on top of that, they'll want to make it a surprise inspection. Third and finally, there is the so-called warrantless inspection, which could happen for a number of reasons. Number one, the employer has granted consent. Secondly, you can have a plain view case where the employer inspected without actually breaching your privacy rights. For example, the agent parked his car on the street and just watched your construction activity. I used to do this a lot from my office window back when I was practicing law. There's a big building going up across the street, and it was fun to look out the window and watch for all the OSHA violations. That's what we call a plain view. I didn't even have to step on your property. These days, I could even take a video with my cell phone, and then I can draw up the citation based on what I saw. Finally, there's the emergency situation. The inspector is driving down the road. He hears or sees or smells something awful coming from the building that makes him think there's a huge OSHA violation going on inside. Maybe he's smelling toxic waste coming out of the plant. If it's an emergency, just as the police could go in immediately to prevent a crime, so can the OSHA inspector. Next slide is employee selection and OSHA. Can the employer consider safety in the way that it selects employees? In other words, could the hazard be the employee? Next slide. This takes us to a brief overview about accident-prone and injury-prone employees. Let's start with the accident-prone employee. This is an employee who has a propensity for mishap. In my life, I think I can say that I really do believe that there are some people who are simply much more prone to accidents than other people. Some people are naturally careless and other people are naturally cautious. Let's start with the question whether the employer must in fact discipline employees who have accidents. The National Realty case that we talked about last time suggests that the answer is yes. Remember, if the employer isn't enforcing its safety rules, it's as if it doesn't have a safety rule at all, and that was part of the claim against National Realty. Now, eventually, that means the employer might even have to discharge an employee who doesn't get the message. We have to acknowledge a caveat here, which is that if the accident has also resulted in a workers' compensation claim by the accident-prone employee, we have to be aware of the fact that this could culminate in a lawsuit by the employee. He may allege that the real cause of the disciplinary action was retaliation. Next question, can the employer try to predict who is accident prone? In other words, I think I can tell which employees are prone to having accidents and which employees are going to be very careful. You might actually have some kind of an agility test, perhaps, for that purpose. Or there might be some other kind of paper and pencil test to test people for cautiousness versus carelessness. I'm not personally aware of any widely used test like that. The more likely problem that you have is that the employer is going to engage in stereotyping. In other words, it's too expensive to design a test for accident proneness. We'll just assume that certain classes of people are prone to having accidents. I know growing up it was an unfair stereotype that women were bad drivers, and so that you would hear a lot of employers explain why they would never hire a woman truck driver. It was because women are bad drivers. That is an illegal stereotype. Older workers tend to face this stereotype, not because they're necessarily careless. In fact, I think older people tend to be a lot more cautious. I know if you've sometimes when I do my shopping in the afternoons and I go to the grocery store, the older drivers seem to drive very slowly and cautiously. You probably noticed a little bit of that too. The stereotyping that could really be illegal by an employer, however, is that older employees have lost their physical and mental capabilities. They're not working at 100% anymore, and so they're more likely to have an accident. And again, if you merely stereotype that age and having an accident are linked, then you're probably violating the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. Let me add to that, however, that the ADEA has some specific exclusions for particular types of occupations. For example, you can engage in age discrimination above a certain age for firefighters and police officers and some other, perhaps, law enforcement or national security positions. Let's go on to the next slide. The injury-prone employee. This is an employee who may be perfectly careful, but even a careful and cautious employee can get sick. The employer has a huge motivation for trying to target and identify employees who are susceptible to illness or injury because these are major costs for the employer in terms of workers' compensation, medical, and disability benefits. Thus, the employer might like to try to predict and reject applicants who are especially susceptible to injury. And we do know now that some people really are built to be more susceptible to certain types of injuries and illnesses than others are. We certainly know that with respect to back injuries, for example. Some people's backs are designed, or they are in a form at birth, which makes them more susceptible to back injury in the long run. We also know that certain people have genetic characteristics that make them more susceptible to getting cancer or lung disease. Could an employer screen applicants to identify these kinds of predictors? Well, remember that the ADA prohibits the employer from conducting those kinds of tests when it's selecting employees in the first instance. It can only have the test as a follow-up after it has offered the applicant a job. The other thing that you have to be aware of is the Genetic Discrimination Act now, the GINA, Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which prohibits an employer from discriminating on the basis of genetic information or record. And that takes us to our next slide, which is Chevron versus Etchezabal, where the employer's Chevron tries to exclude an injury-prone employee. Now, the employee in this case has hepatitis. This makes his liver weaker and more susceptible to all kinds of illnesses, to liver failure and psoriasis. And he's working in a refinery where there's a fairly high or unusual, at least, concentration of carcinogens and toxic wastes. And remember what your filter does. It's the equivalent of your bodily filter. It cleans out your blood, and so this is the organ that's going to have to work overtime if you're working around a lot of toxic wastes. Next slide, is this a case of disability discrimination? Well, here's what happened. Etchezabel had been working around Chevron for a long time with a contractor anyway, but he really wanted to get on as full-time as a full-time employee with Chevron. It was only after he applied for full-time work with Chevron that Chevron discovered that he had this condition. And they only discovered this after they'd already offered him a job. Remember, they could only conduct the medical examination at that point. And when they discover that he's had hepatitis, they withdraw the job offer. So we were absolutely sure that it was the record of hepatitis that caused the rejection. Now, Chevron then adds insult to injury, because Etchezabel can go back to his job with the contractor, but Chevron tells the contractor, we don't even want Etchezabel working on our property when he's your employee. He is barred from working on our grounds. Now, you may wonder if Chevron was just being mean at this point. The explanation is that Chevron's risk is actually much greater if Etchezabel is working on their property as a non-employee, because as a non-employee, he can sue Chevron in tort for exposing him to toxic wastes. An employee who was exposed to such waste and developed an occupational illness would be barred by workers' compensation. Etchezabel will not be barred by workers' compensation. So Etchezabel sues, and he brings his lawsuit under the ADA. He alleges this is disability discrimination. One of the important things that you might have gathered from this case is that an illness or a record of an illness can be a protected disability. Next slide takes us to the question of the so-called direct threat proviso. This is a provision in the Americans with Disabilities Act. It provides a defense for a qualification standard, in other words, a rule that you have for selecting employees, if it's job-related and supported by business necessity. Now, that's a statutory version of the business necessity defense for disparate impact that we learned a long time ago. What kind of standard or qualification might we be talking about? Well, among other things, you could have a general standard that requires that a person may not pose a direct threat to the health or safety of other individuals in the workplace. In other words, your disability makes it unsafe for you to be able to perform this job without hurting other people. Now, that so-called direct threat proviso, does it apply to what happened in this case? Does it validate Chevron's job qualification? And the answer is no. It doesn't validate it, because in this case, Chevron couldn't prove that Etchezabel posed a direct threat to the health of other people. It's his own health that is at stake. And the direct threat proviso simply doesn't apply to this situation. Well, that raises the next question, whether the direct threat proviso implicitly excludes or disqualifies an employer rule that's based on the employee's own personal safety. Let's go to the next slide. This is the title, Proviso is an Example, Not a Limit. Now, Etchezabel raises an argument here, which is that the direct threat to others proviso defines and limits what could be a safety-based business necessity or job-related defense. In other words, the direct threat proviso explains and defines what we mean by job-relatedness if it's based on ability to perform a job safely. Chevron, on the other hand, argues that business necessity and job-relatedness is a broad defense. It could include a lot of things that are not spelled out particularly in ADA. The direct threat proviso is intended only as one example and not a limitation. The EEOC puts in an appearance. It can do that. Remember, the government, either through an agency or the Solicitor General, can appear in any case before the U.S. Supreme Court. That happens here, and the EEOC not only argues in favor of Chevron, it has its own regulation that suggests that self-risk can be a defense and a reason for the employer to reject an applicant under the ADA. Now, this may surprise you a little bit because you may have thought that the EEOC was an agency designed to protect employees. How could it possibly be here supporting the employer? And this is where politics really counts. It depends who's in the White House. That counts when it comes to the EEOC because when the Republicans are in the White House, the tendency has been to use the EEOC office to restrain the growth of discrimination law and even take the employer's position on some issues. Whereas when the White House is held by a Democrat, the tendency has been the other direction, to try to expand employee rights and to expand the law of employment discrimination. Anyway, in this case, the Supreme Court holds the EEOC's regulation is authorized. It's something the EEOC is allowed to do. There is a persuasive argument for it. It's certainly rational, and therefore we uphold the EEOC position. Next slide. Discriminatory paternalism or valid safety concern. A lot of the argument in this case has to do with the history of paternalism, mainly in sex discrimination law. For a long time, employers argued the reason that we don't hire women is that we don't want them to hurt themselves, or they are much more at danger and at risk in the workplace because men will behave badly. And the Supreme Court a long time ago rejected this kind of defense as paternalistic and out of place after Title VII. There are some Supreme Court decisions that in rejecting this kind of paternalism and sex discrimination seem to hold that personal safety is a matter for the employee to decide. And if the court had been consistent with that view in this ADA case where the question is disability discrimination, it might have said that Etchezabal has the right to decide for himself whether he wants to expose himself to this risk. But the court distinguishes those cases from the old days and holds that under the ADA, it is, in fact, authorized to protect the employee from hurting himself, provided that what the employer is doing is not based strictly on stereotype, but it's actually based on an individualized assessment of the employee's condition and proof of an actual safety risk, which sometimes is possible for the employer to prove in a case where we're dealing with illness or propensity for injury. The court also cites the Occupational Safety and Health Act as another federal law that expresses a public policy in favor of safety in selection of employees. And so the court holds that federal policy doesn't necessarily prevent the employer from, you could say, looking out for the employee's safety, but of course we remember what the employer is really doing. The employer is looking out after its own pocketbook. Next slide, game not over, issues on remand for Etchezabal. He hasn't actually lost this case because the case will be remanded for further proceedings, and that's because the direct threat or the self-threat rules are affirmative defenses. Business necessity and job relatedness in general are affirmative defenses, and that means the employer has to bear the burden of persuasion. Important factors that the employer will have to prove: a high probability of risk, which will require medical or scientific testimony, and the severity of the resulting harm. Again, this will require expert testimony about what happens to you if you get psoriasis, for example. The decision that the employer makes must be based on the best available objective knowledge. In other words, the employer can't reject an employee for this kind of self-safety reason unless the employer is acting based on the advice or information of real scientists and doctors, and they're acting on the best available objective knowledge. The employer could get it wrong if it acted on a hunch, And I suppose the employer could get it wrong if it relied on a bad doctor who wasn't really basing his judgment on the best available objective knowledge. Next, the employer, to the extent relevant, has to make an individualized assessment, and that means that in many cases, it's not enough simply to declare that all people with a condition are disqualified. The employer, or rather a doctor, might have to make an individualized assessment about the particular condition of the employee. And finally, there's the possibility of reasonable accommodation. Is it possible, for example, that the employer could protect Echezabo by making him wear a respirator, giving him some extra protection against exposure? Next slide. This brings us to the beginning of our next chapter, Chapter 6, Supervision and Management of the Workplace. Next slide. Sources of a power and right to supervise employees. Where does the employer get this power to tell you what to do? Well, it reminds us of a basic distinction between employees on the one hand versus independent contractors. Independent contractor has the right to decide for himself how he will perform the work. He will decide the details of his own work. Employees, on the other hand, by definition, have submitted to the employer's supervision over the details of the work. And therefore, it's implicit in the employment contract. Now, if it weren't already implicit in the employment contract, remember, the employer has other sources and levers of power. He gets this in part from the right to discharge at will. If the employer can tell you, do what I say or I'll fire you, that makes the employer pretty powerful. The employer has economic superiority in many instances, because when he tells you he's going to fire you, you understand that means unemployment, loss of wages, and the employer perhaps will hurt less from termination than you will hurt. The employer also enjoys some economic superiority because, after all, you're looking to build your career. You want to keep the employer happy. You want to have the possibility, at least, of a promotion, and therefore you're going to tend to do whatever he tells you to do. We have to state a caveat in that last bullet on this slide. There is a possibility of a limitation in the contract that could preserve the employee's right in some sphere, either because the employment is limited to a fixed term. In other words, the employee has a right to work for a year or 2 years, and this will rob the employer of the ability to discharge at will, or because the contract carves out some area of discretion and autonomy for the employee. Next slide. Kelly versus Johnson gives us an example of a battle between employer and employee over autonomy. This is a public workplace. You have police officers. The employer has decided that everybody has to shave. There will be no beards on the force. And the union, through the named parties who are individual officers, is seeking to oppose that rule, goes all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Next slide. A right to personal autonomy? Well, it's important to note that this is a public job setting. And the fact that it's a public job setting gives the employees in this case a little bit more power and a lot more rights than they would have if they were in a strictly private sector workplace. The reason is that when we're in the public sector, the government as an employer is limited by the 1st, 4th, and 14th Amendments, which limits a public entity in its ability to regulate speech, religion, and perhaps other important fundamental liberties. And this is true even when it's trying to limit only its employees, not the general public. Now, when it comes to lifestyle, which may include the way we dress or make ourselves look, this could involve lifestyle, which could involve some of these constitutional rights. Still, employers tend to get away with quite a lot, even in the public sector, when regulating their employees, because to the extent that we're regulating their liberties, Remember, from constitutional law, the general rule is that the government need only prove the basis for its action under a rational standard. In other words, we only need to prove that there's a facially plausible reason for the employer's action, the government's action in this case. Now, there are higher standards if the government is discriminating against a suspect class, for example, based on race, or if the government is infringing on a fundamental liberty, like, for example, your right to marry. But that's not involved when it comes to growing a beard. These are not fundamental liberties, nor is having a beard making this a case of discrimination against a suspect class. There is no suspect class of bearded people. So, does the police department's no beard rule pass the test? And the answer is easily it passes the test, because it need only show that the rule is rational. And the court accepts that the police are quasi-military, and there is some importance in everybody in the force looking the same. It adds to the sense of authority. It helps the public easily identify who's a police officer and who isn't. And we could argue about that, by the way. People do argue a lot about that, and yet it's not enough to prove that it's arguable that the police department is wrong. You could even argue and perhaps succeed in showing that the police department was wrong, but it was rational for the employer to do it, and so the employer wins. Next slide. Other limits on interference with employee autonomy. Well, we might be dealing with other liberties specifically identified by the Constitution, and these are liberties that are fundamental. For example, the right of free speech, the right of religion, the right of association. So if you happen to be a member of the Sierra Club, for example, the employer, in the public sector at least, cannot discriminate against you or prohibit you from being a member of that organization. Maybe the employer's rules impinge upon some fundamental liberty interest that isn't actually stated in the Constitution. And some of the things that have qualified as fundamental liberty interests are those activities that involve family, marriage, and sexuality. So, for example, public sector employers cannot discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. Maybe we have a rule that is either designed to discriminate or has the effect of discriminating against certain classes racially or perhaps religiously. Lots of cases involving religion where the employer doesn't want the employee to wear a particular religious garb. And again, if you're dealing with something like the police department tends to win these cases. In a lot of other cases, though, religion is reasonably, it is, after all, a fundamental interest, and so the employer may have a harder time explaining its grooming rules that limit the strong religious convictions of its employees. Finally, there are some states that have laws that prohibit employers from unduly restricting employee autonomy, even in the private sector. And we're not going to go into a lot of depth about these laws, because they vary from state to state. They tend to raise the standard to something higher than merely rational, to something more reasonable. We don't have such a law, by the way, in Texas, but if you went either to the East Coast or to the West Coast, you'd be much more likely to find these laws. They tend to exempt, for example, to prohibit employers from discriminating against employees for their after-work activities and hobbies and so forth. Well, that's the end of this this lecture. I'll see you again next Tuesday, which will be, I think, October the 18th.